One of the unique experiences in Pigeon Forge, listeners, is a great show adventure that Steve Gibson has produced, and it's a one-of-a-kind, only found in Pigeon Forge, right next to the theater or the attraction that is the Titanic, right across the way, right on the main street there. And Steve is on the show today, and Steve, I'd like to have you share with our listeners a little bit about the show that you've created, and tell us the story of why this is such a special experience for individuals, and more importantly, for groups of all ages to come and see.
Well, American history has been a fascination for most people, for a lot of people, let's put it that way. A lot of folks who went through high school and kind of ignored history kind of regretted it later when they got in their mid-30s. And they look back and think, I should have paid attention. But America has an interest in its history. And our national parks prove that. The numbers of people that go to the national parks are staggering. This time period, the Civil War that we discuss in our show, is very special because it affected so many Americans and changed so many lives and involved so many families. The show that I've written is called Granddaddy's Watch, and it's a play about two siblings from East Tennessee, one Union, one Confederate, running into each other at camp sometime around 1864, and they argue like 2 8-year-olds. The show covers a time span of 1763 to 1865. The Civil War did not start up overnight. It was building from the moment that the colonies were first being formed. And so we go back as a recap for people who slept through high school and get them a chance to figure out what it was that happened and why we ended up shooting at each other. There's a lot of issues involved in this. It wasn't a simple issue. It was not a war of abolition. There are a lot of misleading things that have come down through history. History keeps being rewritten by people almost on a daily basis. And there's an old adage that says, whoever wins the war gets to write the books. Well, the North won the war, so they began to initially rewrite it over time and really turn it into something that it was and it wasn't. I say that it wasn't a war fought for abolition because it was not. What they didn't tell us, for instance, was that when the first 7 states seceded, they took the money that ran the federal government. There was no income tax in 1860, so the only way that revenue was generated in that time period by the government were duties and tariffs, which were provided for by the southern states that left: cotton, rice, indigo, sugar cane, and tobacco. So when the southern states left, they literally crippled the federal government. Well, the North was willing to do whatever it had to do to get the money back, and going to war was not one of those issues initially. So a gentleman by the name of Thomas Corwin of Ohio, a representative, drafted an amendment to the Constitution in February of 1861 called the Corwin Amendment, C-O-R-W-I-N. The Corwin Amendment was going to guarantee that slavery remained legal forever in all the states where it already existed. Unamendable, the term they used, which means they could never change it. The Corwin Amendment passed the House and the Senate and was ratified by 3 states before it fell through. The 3 states that ratified it were Illinois, Ohio, and Maryland. President Lincoln endorsed it in his inaugural address on March 4th, 1861, and 12 days after he was elected, Lincoln sent a letter to every governor in the United States asking them to promote it. So the point is that you got the North willing to keep slavery legal where it was if the South would bring back the money. We were never told this in school, but that changes the storyline completely. And we don't make this stuff up. It's too good. I spent nearly 55 years going back and forth to the National Archives in Washington, looking at the actual documents and letters written by everybody from Abraham Lincoln to Harriet Beecher Stowe. I know what they said, not what somebody said they said. So I tell people at the beginning of our show, as we do our pre-show, I don't read the internet. I don't pick up public school books. And you've got to go back to the source materials. But I'm also explaining too that just because you're reading something written in 1864 doesn't make it true. It means that's what those people believed, or that's what they wanted you to believe. So you got to crisscross your references and read accounts of the same event from different sources. And wherever they meet, there's always a magic moment there somewhere where everybody talks about the same thing. That's usually the truth, and that's what we're looking for. So as a historian, my job is to dig, to become cynical, and be subjective or objective. I cannot take sides in this because it's not my job. A lot of stuff that we've watched on television is very aimed at one side or the other, and that's not our game. We don't play that game, and we don't ignore issues either. Slavery was a big issue, and we talk about that. Probably 2/3 of my show, when you really analyze it, is Black history. And there was more Black history involved in the United States than most people realize. It wasn't just a slavery issue. It was other issues, too. So America has always been a diverse nation. And we've always had minority groups involved in all of our history that we pretty much ignored. The Native Americans, among those, fought in this war. And mostly, by number, according to stats, fought Confederate. The Hispanics, we were all over Southern California, Texas, New Mexico. Most of them also, by number, mostly fought Confederate. But you don't see any Native Americans in the Civil War movies that you watch. You don't see any Hispanics in the movies that you watch. But they were there. And so this show brings back all of those groups back into it and puts it in perspective so that people can understand just how involved this thing was. Again, it's all the entire show is based on actual accounts and storylines and things that I've read in diaries and letters, because those veterans of that time period, they kept great notes and gave you a good insight as what was bothering them and what they had to go through. Part of the problem with history is it became a political tool. It has always been a political tool. And Abraham Lincoln in 1863, to paraphrase him, said that however you train your children in school, that's going to be the next voter base for the next generation. He knew that in 1863. So that's why we have to be careful to teach our children proper history, inclusive history, all of it. Don't pull punches. Kids aren't stupid. They'll figure it out. And give them the truth and let them see what happened. This is a great nation, and we've gone through a lot of growing pains. And we didn't start out perfect, but we came up with this device called the Constitution, which comes close to it. And so the issue of tariffs and slavery and all the other issues that drove us into this war, that's all constitutional. And the arguments were from both sides as to how they interpreted it. Lincoln saw it one way. Jefferson Davis saw it another. And they were all aiming at the same document. They're all trying to figure out what the document said. The more you dig into it, the better it gets. Words change definitions. That's another critical thing for people to understand. When you lose the definition of a term written in 1864 and you apply it to 21st century, you lose what happened. The word nostalgia, for instance, was coined in the late 1600s by an army surgeon describing the condition of a soldier going through combat. Well, it meant shell shock, PTSD, post-war depression. Well, in the 1860s, it meant the same thing. It still meant shell shock. So if you read an account of a Union soldier having nostalgia in 1870, you would think he's having a good time because nostalgia today means something that makes you feel good. Well, that's not what happened. That wasn't how he's feeling. So that's how modern day educators can lose touch with history. If they don't translate everything they read from that time period, literally from an 1828 Webster's Dictionary, which you can get online for free anytime you want it. So you have to be careful what you're reading and how you interpret it and put it in its own time and not judge history, which is what people are tending to do today. So we don't judge history. We analyze it. We just look at everybody at that time period and wonder why they did what they did. And by looking up the cultural changes, and there's a lot of humor in that, too. In the 1860s, a gentleman could not ask a woman a direct question in polite company. It was considered rude. So you couldn't ask a woman, how's your brother? That would have absolutely been scandalous. But what you could do is you could say, I'm assuming your brother's doing well, which means you just made a statement. And if she wants to continue it, she can. If she doesn't, she doesn't have to. We couldn't use any body part you couldn't see in public, you couldn't say in public. So the word leg wasn't used. The word arm wasn't used. Those terms were lower limbs and upper limbs. And so that applied even when you're at the table and you want the leg of the chicken. You couldn't ask for the leg of the chicken because it was rude. So you had to ask for the drumstick. That's where those words initiated.
We're talking with Steve Gibson, who is the creator of a wonderful experience. And when you come to Pigeon Forge, listeners, I highly recommend that you actually take a look at the great website that Steve has when you're planning your trip there. It's great for all ages, especially for an educational tool for children as well. And as Steve says, he does special things for the children. Well, Steve, you started this show and been involved in it for many years. Tell us a story about how the show has evolved.
I was a stand-up cartoonist comedian for 13 years. I illustrated on a giant screen to a monologue set to classical music. It was the unique show of its own kind. I was known as America's fastest cartoonist for years. I ended up performing with symphony orchestras. And in 1991, I was asked by a shopping mall down there where, close to where I live, if I could do something on the Civil War, because they knew I was fascinated by it. And I said, yeah, and that's where it starts. So it began as a traveling show, a two-man play, and we put it in malls and museums and festivals and all kinds of places around the country. And in doing so, I get to meet a lot more people who had direct descendants of the people involved. And I got more inside information from their family's viewpoint that you can't get in public school books, because this is all still family information. In 2006, I got off the road to set up a dinner theater near Chattanooga. And I was there for about 13, 14 years, whatever it was. And we finally made our way to Pigeon Forge. We opened up here in 2019, and here's just where we are. We're diagonally across from the Titanic. So we got this beautiful theater, seats about 540 people. And now we're open every day except Saturdays. That's our religious holiday. That's our Sabbath. So we go from Sunday through Friday, and it's entertaining. The kids, if they got kids, they need to see it because they're going to be exposed to things that they'll never see in schools, private or public, because they're just not teaching all of it anymore. It's become almost an uninteresting or an untouched subject. People getting upset about things, and we don't want to upset anybody. We just want to make sure you know what happened, and we need to maintain this country as a good place to be, and a lot of interesting stuff that happened.
Well, what do you do for groups, and how can they get in touch with you? I'm hoping that you will recommend that great website of yours.
Yeah, the website is just simply civilwartheater.com. And theater spelled with an E-R at the end, the American version, civilwartheater.com. And there's all kinds of visual stuff on there, a lot of text material that you can look at. We offer group rates, of course. A group of 20 or more gets a special rate. And if you have at least 30 or more in a group, we will actually set up a particular time for you. So if you've got a tour bus out there that would like to come in at a particular time, other than what we have scheduled, we'll work that out with you. Of course, that's not a problem at all. We do have to open the doors for the other general public too. Whenever we open up for you, we can't reserve the theater unless you've got at least 100 people. And if you've got at least 100, we'll shut down the theater and do a show just for your group. But it's we're right there on the parkway there in the middle of the mania. And we have a great concession stand. We are not a dinner theater anymore. We used to be, and some of the information on the old website materials that are up there show dinner theater, but we don't do that anymore because this building, we could not convert it with any kind of without costing us an arm and a leg and the rest of my family fortune. So we had to just open it up again as a theater, but we have a concession stand. So anything that people get in the concession stand, they bring it in. We have a unique gift shop. It's full of the actual antiques from that time period, including tear catchers, food pushers, and all the other things that people probably never even heard about. Do you know what a food pusher was?
What's a food pusher, Steve?
Okay. In the 19th century, we still ate like the English. We ate with a fork in the left hand upside down and a big broad knife in the right, and we scooped with the knife and poked with a fork. to get a kid to learn to eat with both hands when they're babies, you put a spoon in their left hand and a food pusher in their right. Food pusher looks like a little hoe, little garden hoe, and he would push the food into the spoon with his right hand and bring the food up with his left hand.
Wow.
That's how you're training them to eat with both hands. So we have our gift shop is filled with that kind of stuff, just that kind of items.
Love to hear that, Steve. We're talking with Steve Gibson. Steve, it's great to talk with you. This is a taste, listeners, of what you'll experience coming to Pigeon Forge and seeing this very special show. Give us that website one more time, Steve, and how we can get in touch with you.
Right. It's civilwartheater.com. I can give you our box office number if you want me to give it to you.
Sure.
It's 423-309-1667. 423-309-1667. And we're open every day, like I said, 6 days a week. People are welcome to call. We have group salespeople that can talk to them. And if they want to talk to me personally, I'll be glad to chat with them. I love to blab with people.
Well, I'm sure that they will be glad to talk with you, Steve. And based on what you said, one of our true experts on the Civil War is in right in Pigeon Forge, listeners. Well, Steve, it's great. Go ahead.
We have fun. That's all I need to say. We do a meet and greet after the show where people can take your pictures with us. We don't charge for that. And we answer all the questions we possibly can. I stay there as late as anybody wants to stay there.
Thank you, Steve. It's great thank to talk you. With you. I want to thank you again for telling us about the story of the uniqueness that offers the Civil War and a lot of redeeming qualities that you'll experience, listeners, when you come to see this great, great show. Well, Steve, it's great to talk with you. I want to thank you again for being on the show. Thanks for being with us.
Yes, God bless you and your audience.